From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, the 28th of April, 2009. Congress takes up new federal hate crimes legislation. We'll hear why some LGBT advocates say it may not be the best approach. We'll go to Pakistan, where fighting between government forces and the Taliban is creeping closer to the capital. And the Supreme Court considers whether states have the power to enforce consumer protection laws when it comes to nationally chartered banks. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A federal appeals court ruled today that an offshoot of Boeing Company can be sued for its part in transporting terrorism suspects who were kidnapped and sent to secret prisons. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that the five plaintiffs suing San Jose-based Jeppesen Data Plan in the secret rendition case can present their case without disclosing top secret information. The panel said that a lower court ruling throwing out the case on the basis of state secrets was inaccurate. In response to swine flu, the FDA widened the dosing population for the antiviral drug Tamiflu today, issuing emergency rules that now allow children less than 1 year of age to receive the drug and increasing dosage for children over one. A handful of U.S. schools were closed as officials determine if ill students actually have the virus. But in Mexico, schools throughout the nation were closed under orders from the Secretary of Health in a preventive measure against the spread of the virus. Shannon Young reports.
Parents throughout Mexico are having to cope with the shuttering of schools at all levels through at least the 6th of May. The government of Mexico City has ordered all restaurants to suspend operations, except for takeout and deliveries. The Food and Agriculture Organization has announced the deployment of a team of experts to Mexico to, quote, help the government assess the epidemiologic situation in the pig production sector. This comes amidst reports tracing the suspected source of the new virus to a pig factory farm in the Gulf Coast state of Veracruz. Meanwhile, the U.S. Center for Disease Control revised its number of documented swine flu cases upwards, with 45 laboratory-confirmed cases in New York City, out of a total of 64 cases nationwide. The disease has also spread at the international level, with cases confirmed in Canada, the United Kingdom, Israel, Spain, and New Zealand. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
After nearly three decades on the Republican side of the aisle in the U.S. Senate, Pennsylvania's Arlen Specter said today that he's switching parties. Specter plans to seek re-election as a Democrat, thereby bringing the U.S. Senate within one vote of being filibuster-proof. That one dangling vote belongs to Minnesota, and the outcome of the protracted Franken-Coleman contest will determine the power balance in the Senate. Venezuela has called its ambassador to Peru home after the Peruvian government granted political asylum to Venezuelan opposition leader Manuel Rosales. Pamela Cueva and Alfredo Cuadros report.
The Peruvian Foreign Secretary José Antonio García Belaúndez.
The Peruvian government, loyal to historic tradition and its commitment with international rights, has decided to grant asylum to the Venezuelan citizen Manuel Rosales.
Rosales is a former presidential candidate and current mayor of Maracaibo, who claims he is being politically persecuted by President Hugo Chavez's government. He arrived in Peru earlier this month and formally requested asylum last week. In Venezuela, Rosales faces corruption charges regarding $60,000 he earned while he was the governor of the state of Zulia. Last week, a Caracas judge ordered his arrest and called for Interpol to investigate. Rosales calls the allegations baseless and says the charges are a political witch hunt. Along with Rosales, two other Venezuelan politicians have sought refuge since 2007, Union leader Carlos Ortega and former governor of Yaracuy, Eduardo Lapi. Meanwhile, left-wing Chavez supporters are calling for mobilizations to demand the cancellation of Rosales' political asylum and calling him a criminal. Pamela Cueva and Alfredo Cuadros, FSRN, Lima.
And President Obama today broadened the scope of Hope for Homeowners, a program crafted last year which was intended to help some 400,000 people strapped by second mortgages. Currently, if a homeowner wants to refinance their first mortgage at a better interest rate, they have to get permission from the second mortgage holder. The expanded program offers incentives to second mortgage holders to modify their loans, therefore paving the way for risky note holders to switch their mortgages to more stable 30-year fixed-rate loans. Almost 30 Nigerian soldiers, all of whom served as UN peacekeepers in Liberia, were sentenced to life in prison today for mutiny. In July of last year, they took to the streets to protest back pay, but the Nigerian court-martial called their civil disobedience a breach of military discipline. Only one of the soldiers who participated in the action was cleared. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
The Supreme Court ruled today that a death row resident in Tennessee was denied key evidence in his trial and ordered a federal review of his sentence. Gary Bradford Cohn was found guilty of murder in 1980. While Cohn's guilt has never been at issue, he invoked an insanity defense, citing post-traumatic stress disorder following his service in Vietnam and subsequent drug addiction. The High Court found that the prosecution withheld information about Cohn's mental state that may well have resulted in a life sentence rather than the death penalty. In another opinion rendered today, justices upheld an FCC rule that bans even one small curse word from live broadcasts, but stopped short of declaring the policy constitutional. They ordered that a federal court decide if the fleeting expletive rule violates the First Amendment right to free speech. The Supreme Court heard a case regarding banking law today and whether a state has the power to examine racial and ethnic disparities when it comes to nationally chartered banks. It all started when then New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer wanted financial institutions to clarify why blacks and Latinos were being charged higher interest rates on their mortgages. He didn't get the answers he wanted. Instead, he was slapped with a lawsuit. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the federal agency which supervises national banks, and the Clearinghouse Association, which is a group of national banks, successfully argued that state attorney generals could not enforce consumer protection laws when it comes to national banks. The state of New York appealed the federal court's decision, and today the High Court heard arguments about whether state controllers can now have a say when it comes to national bank practices. Anne Graham is a professor of law at Texas Tech University School of Law. She explains that state-federal balance is central to the case.
Not only could the attorney general not go into the banks and inspect them, he couldn't even ask them for information voluntarily. He couldn't sue them in court for alleged violations. In fact, he could take no action whatsoever. And that's disturbing to many states. 49 states have filed briefs in support of the New York Attorney General in this case, contending that the Court of Appeals opinion in this case disturbs the federalism, the state-federal balance that's really at the core of our national structure. We have in the U.S. A dual banking system. Some banks are chartered by the states and some are chartered as national banks. And so this creates a very unequal playing field, particularly today when we're looking at the aftermath of a serious predatory lending problem that involved state chartered banks and national banks. It's disturbing to think that the federal regulator is effectively contending that they will not work with the states and allow them to enforce state laws at all, even when they concede that these state laws have not been preempted.
I think that listeners may be surprised that states can't enforce anti-discrimination laws just because a bank is nationally chartered. Has that always been the case?
No, that hasn't always been the case. In fact, national bank regulators only received the authority to enforce state laws in the 1990s. So prior to that time, it was clear that the states could enforce their own state laws. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency adopted a regulation in 2004 that's really at issue here. it's a pretty far-reaching preemptive regulation. And that raises a couple of really interesting questions. Number one, it's doubtful that the federal regulator has either the will or the staffing to enforce consumer protection laws in all 50 states. And it also is disturbing to think that what they're doing is adopting a regulation that preempts state action in any way. And that declaration of preemption is a legal issue. It's nothing within the special expertise of this banking authority. So I think a lot of administrative lawyers are hoping that the Supreme Court will express some opinions about the limits on a federal agency to declare preemption by regulation, and whether the courts in general should defer to an agency interpretation that opines on a legal issue like preemption, or that expands the jurisdiction of the federal agency on its own motion through regulation. So there's a lot of question in this case about what's referred to as Chevron deference. The question is, how much should a court defer to the agency's interpretation?
Ann Graham is a professor of law at Texas Tech University School of Law. The Supreme Court also heard arguments in another case today, taking up the issue of whether school districts should pay for private school tuition reimbursement for certain students with special education needs. The case, Forest Grove School District versus TA, centers on an Oregon family that enrolled directly in a private school and sought reimbursement, but did not make an attempt to use the public school's special education services. The High Court was split after hearing a similar case in 2007. Congress is set to take up hate crimes legislation. The law would be expanded to protect gay, lesbian, transgender, and people with disabilities. Advocates are championing the bill, calling it long overdue. But as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, some LGBT advocates say legislation is not the best way to stop hate crimes.
Advocates point to statistics on hate crimes, nearly 8,000 in 2006, according to the FBI. Rabbi David Saperstein is director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism.
Hate crimes are nothing less than attacks on the very values that are the pillars of our republic and the guarantors of our freedom. They are a betrayal of the promise of America and a rejection of the divine image in which all are created.
Federal hate crime legislation would expand existing law that protects people based on race, ethnicity, and religion. The new bill would include gay, lesbian, transgender people, and people with disabilities. Christine Finch is senior counsel with the Human Rights Campaign.
Sends a message right back that hate crimes will not be tolerated in our society, and then backs that up by giving resources to law enforcement at all levels to help combat this problem.
In addition to law enforcement resources, the Department of Justice would be able to investigate and prosecute for a hate crime if a state is unwilling or unable to do so. But not all LGBT and civil rights advocates are supporters. Avi Skolnick is with the New York City Anti-Violence Project. He says he appreciates the effort, but he thinks the bill promotes criminalization in a society that already over-criminalizes.
We worry that our communities end up being less safe in the long run because people are going into prison for much longer than perhaps they would have if they hadn't been convicted also with a hate motive component, stewing over that, and potentially being violent towards LGBT people and other marginalized communities while in prison, and then get out and again are able to sort of continue being violent because there was no there's no restorative justice or rehabilitation or any attempts to sort of unlearn hate while they're in prison.
Skolnick offers this alternative.
There could be things included that are currently not in the legislation, such as restorative justice options for victims and funding for community-based prevention initiatives.
Wade Henderson with the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights responds to that critique. He says the scope of jurisdiction is limited.
But its symbolic power and its ability to send a signal to the country and, in fact, to the world that the federal government of the United States views these crimes of violence, again, crimes of violence, directed at individuals for the reasons that we've stated, to be serious enough to have the federal government's imprimatur in trying to ensure the adequate prosecution at the state and local level where necessary.
Opposition is also coming from the religious right. Reverend Anthony Evans is president of the National Black Church Initiative. He says this bill attacks free speech and is attempting to, quote, normalize homosexuality.
If we preach the gospel as the gospel is written in the Bible, and someone took that literally and go after somebody in the street and they just so happened to be homosexual, that person is charged with a felony crime and then we are liable.
Reverend Evans also says he's worried about federal funding that his church receives. Advocates say the legislation does not impact speech, that it is narrowly written to criminalize actions that result in bodily harm or death. The legislation could be voted on in the House of Representatives this week. It must then go to the Senate. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C. As FSRN reported yesterday, the battle to curb greenhouse gas emissions is heating up in Washington. Today, we take a closer look at one provision, the controversial cap-and-trade program. As Yame Shea reports, before Democrats face off with Republicans, they have to slug it out among themselves.
The House Energy Committee is debating a climate change bill that runs over 600 pages. By Washington standards, that's only a sketch. Nonetheless, Committee Chairman Henry Waxman says it's a blueprint to a bright future.
This will be accomplished just through unleashing new investments in technology that I think will provide millions of jobs for Americans and bring us back into the leadership of the country that is doing the most, not the least, in trying to protect our environment.
The centerpiece of the House bill is a cap-and-trade system. The cap is a nationwide emissions limit set by the government. It would decline each year so that by 2050, the U.S. would generate 83% fewer emissions than in 2005. Most companies would have to get emissions permits from the government, and those who emit less can sell their credits on a carbon market.
The cap-and-trade system is absolutely the bankers on Wall Street's wildest dream come true.
Seattle Democrat Jim McDermott likes the caps and the permits, not so much the trading part. For him, a carbon market would be equivalent to the subprime housing mess on steroids.
Because they will have access to huge amounts of money, and they can manipulate 30, 40, 50 years out in advance, and they'll just have a futures market and everything else. You have to believe in the tooth fairy to believe that we can regulate the cap and trade system.
McDermott has drafted his own plan that does away with the carbon market. The government would take money from companies and recycle it back to consumers. No matter how you skin the cat, everybody agrees that burning oil and coal would be more costly. That doesn't sit well with Texas Democrat Gene Green, a member of the Energy Committee.
The refining that we do in Houston, Texas could easily be transferred to China or India or Libya or Saudi Arabia, who would love to be enhance their product instead of being crude oil suppliers. They would love to be refined product suppliers.
Democrats from oil and coal-producing states meet often on Capitol Hill, brainstorming strategies to preserve fossil fuel industries back home. Publicly, they talk the most about consumers facing bigger utility bills. Here's Oklahoma Democrat Dan Boren.
I have one of the poorest congressional districts in the country, and the last thing that we want to see happen is, grandma and grandpa on a fixed income, and they don't have much disposable income for them to have a $200 or $300 bill can really affect their bottom line, whether or not they're going to buy prescription drugs or buy groceries.
Then there are Democrats from industrial states.
I come from a state that generates about 90% of its electricity from coal.
Zach Space of Ohio says free trade agreements have sent many factories overseas. He's worried that cap and trade would chase even more companies away.
If a manufacturer closes its doors here, it moves to India or China and pollutes more where they have no standards, we're really defeating the purpose of the legislation in the first place, and we're undermining our economic stability.
Democratic leaders who are writing the bill seem to be eager to win over wavering colleagues. They've already added subsidies for clean coal and are looking for help from manufacturers. Oklahoma Congressman Tom Cole, who's a member of the Republican leadership team, sees an opening.
The Democratic coalition is very weak. I think they're going to have a very hard time achieving unity on their side in the House, and I think it'll be even worse in the Senate.
But even if Republicans manage to keep Democrats divided, the administration can regulate carbon dioxide through an existing law. President Barack Obama has not ruled out that plan, but said he prefers lawmakers to craft a compromise. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ye Mei Shi in Washington.
Black farmers demonstrated in front of the Department of Agriculture in Washington today, telling the Obama administration to move on payouts for past discrimination. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
It's been a decades-long fight. Black farmers, many in the South, thought they had won the battle after Congress made the USDA pay up on a decade-long lawsuit on discrimination. But some of the money hasn't been allocated, and black farmers say the Obama administration has been slow to act. President of the National Association of Black Farmers, John Boyd.
Not only do they need it, it's in law, it's in writing. Why can't we get this process executed? And why is the only piece in the farm bill that hasn't been implemented is the piece for the black farmers? That's the real issue here. And we have an African-American president, and we were out here today to remind him that these people need help, too.
In 1999, the government agreed to pay farmers who were discriminated against by the USDA. Then Senator Barack Obama spearheaded an effort to get all the farmers their money, an additional $100 million. But the farmers had two complaints, one that the money hasn't been given out, and also that the $100 million payment is inadequate. It would not give all farmers their due. Again, John Boyd.
We'll be able to pay up to those 1,600 farmers would be able to receive a check. And we would have to get a judgment and go back to Congress to repay the remaining farmers. So either way, we want to see the process put in place and started, because right now we don't have anything. We have $100 million sitting there, and not one black farmer has received a dime.
Black farmers have complained about discrimination since the creation of the USDA. For example, payments and loans were given to white farmers but were denied to black farmers. It was the basis of the lawsuit that began in 1994. Director of the USDA Coalition of Minority Employees, Lawrence Lucas, represents farmers and employees. He says the problems within the USDA are institutional.
In order for this administration to solve the problems of the farmers, they also have to solve the problems of the ongoing and long vestige of discrimination within the department. We know that the legacy of USDA is in fact the last plantation, and they do have a culture of indifference, a culture of racism, sexism, and sexual abuse. That has been proven. And what we are concerned about is that the people who are now heading this administration in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, we don't feel as though they're doing a good enough job with solving the problem of the systemic problems of all the Department of Agriculture, and not just identify a problem because we're here on the mall talking about black farmers.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has recently released a memo saying that the department is trying to correct past civil rights wrongs in the department. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Pakistan's government forces have opened a new battlefield just 100 miles from the capital, Islamabad, as the military extends its fight against Taliban militants. The latest offensive threatens a delicate peace deal between the Taliban and the government and is displacing hundreds of civilians in the process. Rose Katabchi reads for our correspondent in Peshawar, Gabe Matthews.
In Pakistan's northwest frontier province today, an aerial attack in the Dir Agency killed dozens of suspected Taliban militants, according to the Pakistani military. Pakistani General Arthur Abbas says their attack killed about 70 militants and some 10 security forces are also dead.
They made trenches on top of the mountain in Baner and started threatening people. The Taliban did not get out of Baner, but to deceive people, just a few left. So we started our operation. We have confirmed that militants received arms, money, radio sets, heavy weapons, and communications equipment from abroad.
Or heavy weapons hai aur trans ye communication equipment hai ye inke paas bahar se aaya hai.
Deir is about 100 miles northwest of the capital, Islamabad. Many fled this region due to the bombing and airstrikes. Security forces ended their military operation in Deir, the hometown of Sufi Muhammad, who initiated peace talks between the government and Taliban. Meanwhile, in nearby Bunir, another military operation is underway because hundreds of militants are in the region defying an order from the government to leave. Peace talks between militants and the government have been called off. Asif Khan is a resident of Bunir.
I don't know what we've done to deserve so much suffering. I know we left our village due to the Taliban and fear for our lives. I'm not sure what will happen to us because I do not trust the government or think they will help us or provide us any shelter. We left our homes in a hurry and still have not decided where to go. We're helpless.
Violence and tensions between the Pakistani military, Taliban militants, and civilians are increasing daily. Hundreds of thousands of people are being displaced, and many fear Taliban takeover of their villages as well as Pakistani and U.S. military attacks. While the Taliban try to win over tribal people, they are also cracking down on freedom of speech. In the Swat Valley, Taliban militants distributed pamphlets warning the media against reporting negatively about them and accusing journalists of being U.S. spies. Hamid Mir is a senior journalist for GOTV.
We are not afraid of anyone issuing pamphlets against us or anyone enforcing rules for journalists. We stood against the dictator Musharraf, and now we will stand against the Taliban.
40,000 people have migrated from this area since recent military operations in Bunir and Deir, and soon more will leave. In this scenic mountainous region, some analysts say it will not be easy to disarm the militants. Reading for FSRN's Gabe Matthews in Peshawar, I'm Rose Kitabchi.
And now, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Of pirates and piracy. In the news of late is the piracy drama off of Africa's Horn, the eastern coast of Somalia. All of a sudden, piracy is a problem, one needing military, if not global, solutions. Every petty politician is bum-rushing the mic to spout off on how pirates are thugs, criminals, or the latest Western curse, terrorists. Behind these events lie a history that cries out for clarity and perspective. If piracy is a crime when individuals do it, what is it when states do it? Who can deny that America was stolen and swindled from the Indians, or that millions of people were stolen from Africa to work for them for centuries? Is that piracy or just plain policy? Piracy did occur in the 17th and 18th centuries, and this was either conflict between colonial powers or in pursuit of profit. Pirates are retail. Nations are wholesale. Who are the thugs, the criminals, the real pirates? To my knowledge, no band of pirates has ever stolen a nation. Guess who has? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
Come see what's done happened to me.